Welcome back to the Kurdish Research Audio Archive.
Great to be back.
This is part two in our 10-part series looking into the history of Afrin.
That's right.
And today we're focusing squarely on, well, a really crucial time, the French Mandate period, specifically the years 1920 through to 1946.
A period of massive change for the area.
Absolutely. We're going through the source material to get a handle on how this region, historically Kurd-Dagh, was actually administered under the French.
Yeah, and how people there responded, what the key developments were during those, well, pretty pivotal decades.
So to understand this mandate era, we really have to start with the big picture, right? The end of World War I.
Exactly. The collapse of the Ottoman Empire, it just shattered the old order across the Middle East, a total reconfiguration.
And plans were already being made before the war even ended, weren't they? Things like the Sykes-Picot Agreement.
That's right, the secret agreement from 1916. Britain and France basically carving up spheres of influence, you know, even while the fighting was ongoing.
So Sykes-Picot was the, let's say, backroom deal.
And then the San Remo Conference in 1920 sort of formalized it all under the new League of Nations mandate system.
That's when France officially got the mandate for Syria and Lebanon.
Correct.
Now, I know the dates can be a bit tricky. Officially, the mandate is often listed as, what, 1923 to 1943?
Yeah, that's the formal time frame often cited. But the sources we're looking at, and for our purposes today, we're covering that broader stretch of French presence and influence, starting right from 1920 and going up to 1946. It gives a fuller picture.
Makes sense. And during this time, Kurd-Dagh, or Afrin, gets incorporated into French Syria. How did that work administratively?
Well, it was set up as a kata. Think of it like an administrative district.
Okay.
And that kata was initially part of the state of Aleppo, which itself was under French control. Later, these states were unified into Syria. Still under the mandate, of course.
But the ultimate boss was always the French High Commission.
Always. Based in Beirut, they held the final authority.
So, France is in charge. What did their actual policy look like on the ground in Afrin? The sources seem to suggest it wasn't just one simple approach.
No, definitely not simple. The sources describe it as ambivalent, really, a real mix.
Ambivalent how?
Well, you see elements of direct control, certainly. Military presence, suppression of any armed resistance.
That's the Chet you mentioned. The armed band.
Exactly. Those groups. And later the Murid movement, too. The French put those down.
Yeah.
And they established their own administrative structures, like the Kata system itself.
Okay, so there's the control aspect. But you also mentioned co-option.
Yes, that was crucial. They weren't just trying to rule by force everywhere. They actively tried to, well, co-opt local power structures.
How did they do that?
By forming alliances with powerful local figures, the agas, the traditional leaders, trying to bring them into the French system.
Offering them positions or influence?
Sometimes, yes. Or making concessions. Things like allowing locals to be recruited into administrative roles or permitting Kurdish language use in certain contexts.
No.
And they even recruited Kurds into their own military forces, the Troupes Spéciales du Levant.
Interesting. And the sources also mention managing populations.
That's another key point. They weren't passive observers. They got involved in managing demographic flows, notably encouraging Kurdish refugees fleeing, say, Turkey, to settle in the area. That had its own impact, naturally.
Right. So that brings us to the internal dynamics. How did the existing social structures, like the tribes, actually fare under French rule? Did they fade away?
Well, the tribal structure certainly went through changes. Some analyses suggest maybe a weakening of their formal political power compared to Ottoman times.
But they didn't disappear.
Oh, absolutely not. The sources are clear. Local tribal leaders, the agas, and tribal affiliations in general remained incredibly influential. Their social standing, their economic power, that was still very real.
So even with the French administration layered on top, the agas were still key figures people looked to.
Definitely. And you see Kurdish political figures from Afrin, often tied to these tribal interests, actively engaging with the French mandate authorities.
Who are we talking about?
Figures like Nuri Khanj from the really influential Al-Khanj or Battle family. He was active in Aleppo politics. Or someone like Hassan Ouni from the Shikhan tribe, participating in mandate era elections.
So they were navigating the new system.
Exactly. Sometimes using their connections, maybe even links to movements like the Muridia, to gain leverage within that system.
And it sounds like the French might have played different groups off against each other sometimes, similar to the Ottomans.
That pattern seems clear in the sources, yes. The mandate authorities weren't above exploiting existing tribal divisions or backing certain factions to, maintain control and prevent a united front against them.
So you saw a mix of responses from the tribes themselves.
You did. Some tribes, like the Amkan and Shekan, are mentioned as being involved in resistance at times. Others found ways to accommodate or even collaborate with the French. It just shows the complex calculations people had to make under colonial rule. How to survive, how to maintain some influence.
And a major instance of resistance that stands out is the Murid movement that was in the 1930s.
Yes, that's a really significant episode. Led by a figure known as Naqshi Sheikh, Khalil Ibrahim Soghoukolou.
What made it significant?
Well, according to the sources, it wasn't just political resistance. It was this blend of spiritual leadership, specifically Naqshbandi Sufi leadership, combined with very real social grievances.
Grievances against who?
Against local landowners, some of whom were perhaps seen as exploitative, and also directly against the French mandate authorities. It brought together spiritual devotion and political action.
And it was based at the Nabi Huri Shrine Complex. That seems important.
Very. The sources pinpoint Nabi Huri as its headquarters. It really underscores how these revered religious sites could become, well, powerful centers for mobilization, both social and political. It kind of embedded this specific, politically charged form of Naqshbandism into the region's collective memory.
Now, shifting slightly, another major change during this period was demographic, wasn't it? The arrival of Armenian refugees.
Yes, a huge influx. Their arrival in Syria, and that included Afrin, was a direct result of the violence and, frankly, the attempted annihilation they faced elsewhere, especially following World War I.
And they arrived under terrible circumstances.
Absolutely devastating conditions. The sources mentioned disease, famine. It was an incredibly difficult time for them to arrive.
How were they received initially? Was it straightforward?
No, it was quite complex, according to the sources. Initially, there was sometimes friction, even resentment.
Why was that?
Well, sometimes they were blamed for worsening economic hardship, which wasn't fair, but happened. And sometimes they were perceived as being too close to the French authorities.
Because the French provided aid.
Exactly. The French offered humanitarian assistance and sometimes administrative roles, which were lifelines for the refugees, but could cause suspicion among parts of the local population.
But that relationship evolved.
It did, yes. The sources indicate that relations, particularly with Arab nationalists, tended to improve over time. A key moment was when Armenians were granted Syrian citizenship in 1924.
Ah, okay.
And later on, you even see Armenian communities being mobilized as a voting bloc, sometimes actually supporting nationalist movements against the French. So a real journey of integration and shifting political alignments.
The sources also mentioned something about friction with the existing Armenian community.
Yes, that's an interesting detail. There was already a small established Armenian community in Syria before the genocide, sometimes called the Arman al-Qadim, or Old Armenians.
And they were worried.
They were apparently concerned, according to some sources, that this huge influx of impoverished refugees might negatively affect their own social standing and integration. It just highlights the internal complexities even within minority groups during such upheavals.
Okay, let's talk about the cultural and religious landscape a bit more. Sufism seems prominent in the sources for this period.
It really does. The Naqshbandiya and the Rifaiya Sufi orders are noted as having a significant presence in Kurdog.
Any key figures mentioned?
Sheikh Hasan al-Naqshbandi is recognized as the chief sheikh of the Naqshbandiya in the area. His Zawiya, his Sufi center, basically in Afrin, was apparently a destination for pilgrims.
And these Sufi networks, were they purely religious?
Not at all. A really key insight from the sources is how these networks acted as like vital bridges. They mediated the relationship between rural Afrin and the big city Aleppo.
How so?
Facilitating the movement of people, of goods, even cultural practices and ideas. They were really important social and, frankly, economic connectors.
And Nabi Huri keeps coming up.
It really does. That shrine complex is presented as such a powerful focal point. It embodies so much of the region's layered history, its syncretic nature.
And as we said, it was the headquarters for the Murid movement.
Which just underlines its significance beyond pilgrimage. Mm-hmm. It was a site of action. And the sources also briefly mention that the French actually had an interest in the historical aspects of the site Siris, its ancient name, even before the mandate.
Oh, really?
Yeah, which apparently laid some groundwork for archaeological work that happened later during the mandate period.
Fascinating. Okay, what about the economy? How did things function under the mandate?
Well, the sources confirm what we might expect. The economy was fundamentally tied to the land, to geography. Agriculture was absolutely central.
And the star player was olives.
Unquestionably. olive cultivation was just dominant. It's what gave the region its reputation, those extensive groves. It made it distinct from other parts of Syria, maybe focused more on grain or cotton.
Where did the olives and other products go?
Traditionally, the region's economy looked towards two main markets, Kilis, which is now in Turkey, and Aleppo.
Ah, but the new border after World War I must have affected the Kilis connection.
Massively. That's a really crucial economic point the sources highlight. The new international border effectively severed that long-standing, very important link to Kilis.
So Afrin became more dependent on Aleppo.
It seems likely. It potentially made the region more vulnerable to, say, price fluctuations in the Aleppo market or any disruptions on that route, because that older dual market access was gone.
Oh, Hannah the Chai Lady is here. Rage Bosch, Hannah.
Perfect timing. Little pause is good.
Let's take a moment. Oh, that smells wonderful today. Let's see. Sip. Needs a little more sugar today, I think. A bit bitter for my taste.
Really? Mine seems pretty good today. Warm and comforting.
Well, maybe just my cup. But yeah. Still, a good cup of chai, always welcome. Always.
Agreed.
Okay, so picking back up where we left off, we've covered quite a bit of ground for the mandate period.
Yeah, we have.
We looked at the French approach, that mix of control and co-option, how local leaders, the agas, navigated that.
Right. And the resistance, too, like the Murid movement and where it was centered.
And the big demographic shifts with the arrival of Armenian refugees, their initial struggles and eventual integration.
Plus the enduring role of Sufism and cultural sites like Nabi Huri, acting as connectors and even centers of action.
All set against that backdrop of an economy heavily reliant on olives, now having to deal with a new border cutting off Kilis.
It really paints a picture, doesn't it? A region under intense external pressure from the mandate.
But not just passively receiving it.
Exactly. Local structures, the tribes, the agas, cultural networks, historical sites, they all remained incredibly relevant. They became arenas for, well, for negotiation, for accommodation, but also for resistance.
So if we were to summarize the French mandate period in Afrin, say 1920 to 1946, it's really about the establishment of French control, but a control that had to constantly interact with local power.
Definitely. That complex relationship with the tribes and agas, involving both suppression and these attempts to bring them into the system.
And we saw the population responding in different ways, accommodation, resistance, like the Mirids.
Based out of Nabi Huri, which itself highlights the site's importance.
We saw major demographic changes with the Armenian refugees, adding another layer to society there.
And the continued vitality of cultural and religious life, especially Sufism, connecting the rural areas to Aleppo, and sometimes fueling political currents.
And underpinning it all, an agricultural economy adapting, however imperfectly, to new political and economic boundaries.
I think the key takeaway from the sources for this period is that it wasn't just about French actions. It was a time where new borders, new systems were imposed, yes, but local communities, local actors, were constantly shaping, resisting, and navigating their reality within that new framework. It was dynamic.
Which leads to a final thought, maybe for you listening. When you consider how these traditional leaders, the agas, religious figures like the Nashi Sheikh, and even newly arrived groups like the Armenian refugees, all had to navigate the complex power dynamics of the French mandate, what does this era really tell us about how local identities and communities manage to persist, or how they get fundamentally transformed when faced with external rule, especially in these historically fluid border regions?
Something to really ponder.
Indeed. Well, that concludes our look at the French mandate period in Afrin for today. Thank you for joining us on the Kurdish Research Audio Archive.
Yes, thanks for tuning in. Join us next time as we continue our exploration of Afrin's history.